Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, welcome to CarCast and Edmunds Podcast. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndre, here with Alistair Weaver. And welcoming our guest, a friend of the show for many, many years, Patrick Long, race car driver. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here. Good to connect with you guys. It's been a little while.
Yeah, it's funny how we all do this sort of via Zoom now, just record the video, because I know you've been to the studio a number of times, and I prefer that, but this kind of came up kind of last minute. We want to talk about some of the events that you guys are doing, but those of you that listen to CarCast should be familiar with Patrick. But if you're not, a fantastic race car driver, has won Le Mans several times, Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona, 12 Hours of Sebring, Petit Le Mans, 12 Hours of Bathurst, American Le Mans Series champion, Pirelli world champion, and I'm probably just scratching the surface. It's everything out there that could be won on four wheels, I think you have won, and congratulations for that.
Thank you.
It's interesting, because one of the things I wanted to bring up before we get into the event side is you've been out there with us at Monterey many times. I know you spend most of the time at the track, getting an opportunity to hop from vehicle to vehicle, which has got to be pretty fun. One of the things that came up is we talked about driving Adam's Corolla's Porsche 935 at one point. Did you drive? You did drive that car, right? Didn't you?
I worked with Adam a couple of years when he was driving that car, but I've never been behind the wheel of that car. I've driven some other 935s and just absolutely love any opportunity to jump in those cars, let alone any vintage car with big pedigree like that car.
I know you were there and we were talking about it, and I just don't remember if you got a chance to drive. We were talking about it, and I just think your schedule was jammed. You were just already committed to several other cars. So I'm sure it's available to drive at some point, and you're going to be probably disappointed that it's slow and old.
No, I mean, geez, the legacy of that car and so many heroes involved, and you know, it's great to drive these cars, to experience these cars, to go fast, to try to tame them and tune them, but there's also this time machine aspect to it, where you're jumping in a car that finished second at Le Mans overall, and if I have my facts correct,
yeah, and first in something class.
And something that Paul Newman so famously made his name in at Le Mans. You know, obviously Dick Barber was somebody that was a big part of the beginnings of my tenure at Porsche. I started with them in the end of 2002, and Dick very much was and still is a big part of that legacy. So yeah, I love how these cars carry the stories with them through different ownerships, through different events, and you can definitely get a lot from just being around them and feeling that energy, but driving them is certainly that sort of teleporting experience.
Pat, we were all at Rennsport last year, and was it things like Goodwood Revival, and they're driving the old cars in anger. You know, you see a lot of F1 guys and everything else get into these cars that are worth, you know, $15 million or something. What is that sense of responsibility? Because, you know, you're still a racing driver, you want to win, but at the same time, you are sitting in like a $15 million museum piece.
Yeah, it's a fine balance. It's a great question. I think that a lot of these cars run better and are ultimately safer being driven the way they were designed to be driven. That doesn't mean grabbing them by the scruff of the neck and driving them like a 2024 Formula One car. But at the same time, they don't really want to be babied around. And as a driver, I'm better and more consistent and treating the car with respect if I really do hit my marks and wind it up and clean them out. So it's not red line shifts. It's not last of the late breakers, but you do lean on them and within reason, as long as you know who's prepped the car and you know who you're around on track, you do definitely want to give them a bit of a run. So it's interesting. I'll tell a story. Last year, I raced at Long Beach in the FW07 Williams Formula One car. This was Rosberg's winning car from Monaco. And as I'm sitting in this car and thinking about the danger aspect, the value of this car, which I didn't even want to know what it was worth. And I'm out there being asked to race this car and ultimately put on a show, but also do the car justice. And so I went out and thought to myself, well, I'll start at about 70% and get my bearings and really learn this car. And quickly what I realized is the car didn't want to be driven at 70 or 75%. It didn't run at 70 or 75%. I mean, the way that that Cosworth engine was tuned and mapped, it has to be all or nothing. So yeah, is it 100%? No, but it's 98.5.
Just for anybody listening who's not familiar, this is not Nico Rosberg from the Mercedes days. This is Keke Rosberg, his dad, who was famously enjoyed a cigarette, stubbed the cigarette out and famously did like 150 mile an hour lap, wasn't it? So this is early 80s Formula One.
Correct. With,
what was it, 1.6 turbo and like 1,000 horsepower? And
yeah, this was an NA engine, last of the flat bottoms, very, very raw, very high revving engine, 6-speed. If I'm remembering correctly, very short throw manual gearbox, right down to your right. And high RPM meant that a short throw of a very tight gearbox in a single seater like that, where basically I'm a small guy, I'm 5'8", 155 pounds, and my shoulders were on the cockpit edges. So there's not a lot of movement or a room or space inside of these cars. But again, yeah, you have to run them and clean them out. It's a little bit like a two-stroke dirt bike from the 80s or 90s. They really only run in the high peak RPM. So you have to kind of get them on the pipe and keep them on the pipe. So I love driving these cars. Again, I'm very selective in working with teams and owners who do the right amount of prep and take things seriously. But after that, it's about doing the car justice and putting it on display for people to really hear it, see it, feel it.
Because they are terrifying, isn't it? When you look back at, it's not just the sort of single seats. I remember getting into a Group B rally car and the roll cage was about, you know, 1-inch diameter. Old racing cars are scary things. It's not surprising that so many people got killed.
It was a different era, a different time. We only knew, or they only knew what they knew. And you know, the question mark will be, does that evolution slow as we really do peak out with the understandings of carbon monocoques and really thick layers of carbon fiber? Obviously now in the open wheel cars, a lot more protection around the driver's head. So I think there's been a lot of innovation and evolution in safety. I remember it like yesterday when we started wearing Hans devices and head and neck restraint systems that you run between your seatbelts tethered to your helmet. And that felt very clunky. It felt very risky in a way and uncomfortable, but it set a new standard. And here we are over 20 years later, and the technology there hasn't changed that much. It's still, for all intents and purposes, if I wore a 2003 Hans device today racing, it would still factor in. Obviously, they have to have the safety codes and checks up to speed, but the design and the way that they construct those haven't evolved much. So I do wonder if we're really getting to a peak on a lot of ideas in engineering. So that makes me feel good about current pro drivers and how much safer the sport is than 30, 40, 50 years ago.
I mean, a long way from, say, the Maserati Birdcage. Seen that car, exactly. Right? And yeah. Actually, speaking of the 935s that they ran in the day, the original roll cage that we took out of that car was aluminum. It's lightweight, and they ran oil through it. It was used as like an additional oil cooler. So I was like, it just seems crazy to me. It's funny that you mentioned the modern technology. I think at the Grand Prix of Long Beach coming up this weekend, they are debuting the new Halo for IndyCar, which has some additional venting in it. And they talked about the titanium structure and how it attaches to the chassis and what the whole thing weighs. And it's a little bit lighter overall, and it has much better cooling for the driver. But I didn't know how sophisticated it was, and that there's two versions of it. They have a version of it that's a little lighter with a little bit thinner glass for the road courses, and then a little bit thicker glass for the ovals, like the Indy 500. It's like a 9mm versus a 6.8mm glass. So pretty high tech, and even in that kind of development of what they've done.
Yeah, for sure. I think that that was a massive pivot for IndyCar racing, to have a complete sort of canopy around the driver. And there was a lot of resistance. There was many years of different designs being submitted, and a lot of people thought, well, we're going to lose fans. We're going to lose the spirit of what an IndyCar looks like, what an IndyCar drives like. But I would venture to guess that if you asked the current field, how many of them would go into the Indy 500 this year without the canopy, and I don't think you'd have a single taker. It's one of those things. It takes a little while for it to be adopted, but once it's there, it really does become a no-brainer. So I think they've done a good job there. And with Formula One, you know, running a similar structure and system without the glass, if you will, or the Lexan.
Yeah, you know, we've spoken to a bunch of the drivers, especially from IndyCar, and honestly, it was kind of a non-issue. Now they're just like, yeah, safety is fine with us. Like, we'll make it work, and it's fine. Like, nobody was really against it, as you said.
Pat, yeah, if we're sure on the subject, sorry, go on.
Yeah. I just think there was a big adjustment, and probably still is, for the drivers with heat and temperature, because it is a little bit of an oven factor when you take all of that wind flow that they were so used to. But there's been, you know, advances there with cool suit usage, and as you said, this new evolution with a lot more ventilation. So yeah, they're definitely progressing there, and that helps a lot. But all in all, I'm sure they don't miss the buffeting and the turbulence that they, yeah, they now don't have to deal with as much.
Switching to the road, because we're talking about 1,000 horsepower Formula One cars and Indy cars and everything else. But have you had a, we were talking last week on the show, went out to Spain and drove the Taycan Turbo GT, Vizac edition for its full title. Have you had a chance to drive that yet?
I haven't yet. It's been incredible to see some of the numbers that car is putting out performance-wise. And I know Lars Kern has been sort of the lead driver on that program. But I was speaking to Jörg a little bit, Jörg Bergmeister, about it a week or so ago. But yeah, they were out here in California and I missed them. I was in some other country at the time, but looking forward to getting a shot at it.
You know, but it's an interesting thought process, though, because I mean, look, I get it. You've had such a long career with Porsche and still work with them all the time. So there's really not much bad to say in those regards. But the car that Alistair's talking about, over 1,000 horsepower, but it weighs 5,000 pounds. It's a sedan. And then they do the version with the rear seat delete, but it's still a four-door. Like, are we getting a little too ahead of our skis with trying to make that into such a wildly high performance vehicle when they have, maybe not just Porsche specifically, but what we're doing with crazy SUVs and super sedans versus the sports cars? It just seems like a bit much.
Yeah, I'm a little far from it, but what I would think is that this is a display of performance. This is a little bit of competition. This is a little almost like reading a car review. You're buying a sedan or an SUV, and you're comparing, not necessarily about the application that you will be putting the car through, if I were to guess, but more so max peak performance. I know I drive a Taycan GTS, and it's a daily driver. It's a round town car. It's something that point A to point B with great design and engineering. But I never envisioned taking that car to the track. There's different tools for that challenge.
Because one of the things about it, obviously, like, best part of 1,100 horsepower. But you don't. What I was expecting a little bit more was something akin to like a GT3 or GT3 RS. But it's so heavy that they've had to kind of wind back the ABS. The ABS kicks in a lot earlier. So it's more like a Cayenne GT and Turbo GT in philosophy. This is going to be a challenge, right? You've driven so many race cars that you get lighter and heavier. It's really hard to do a 5,000-pound car that feels light. And I think they've done an amazing job with the engineering. Obviously, it's got tons of grip, tons of power, so you get the lap times out of it. But you never kind of get past the fact that it's, you know, twice the weight of a 911.
Right. No, I mean, I think that the GT cars and everything that's progressing over there, that's really what our track weapons are about. And I think that sometimes the dress shoe that you wear, you kind of like to know that it could run a marathon if you really needed to, but you're never really going to run in that shoe. So that's just my personal opinion. Again, I'm a little further from the product strategy of ultimately where that car is marketed to be used, but it's great to know how capable it is and what those performance values are. But in the end, you know, I think when you talk about electrification and going out to the track, that's kind of a to watch space, just from the pure debate of, okay, so you're going to do a run and then recharge. Yeah, if the capabilities are there at the track and that's the way that we need to go track driving in the future, it's certainly nice to know that Porsche is out ahead of that. But I'm still going to the track with a GT3 RS or even just an ST.
I mean, listen, it's incredible.
Just an
feat.
ST, yeah.
Yeah, just an ST. It's an incredible technological feat in engineering and software that's making these things happen. If you think 20, 25 years ago, what a 5,000-pound luxury, you know, like sports sedan or SUV would be, you wouldn't really think too much to bring it on the track. But now it is fully capable. And I don't know if you can just do it with mechanical parts. It has to be done with software as well to make that thing stick and handle and perform at a level that it does, especially at that weight. But going back a few years, and Alistair brought this up before we started, you and I, Pat, we probably bumped into each other at the LA Auto Show, and Porsche was debuting a hybrid racing car, and it had the I don't even know what we're calling it, sort of this centrifugal sort of device in the passenger seat, and we were looking at it.
It was a flywheel.
It was a flywheel, right? We were looking at it, and you were explaining it, and we were all kind of looking at it going, that seems wildly dangerous to have sitting next to you. But explain that one, because that was sort of the beginning of sort of the idea of a hybrid, Porsche at least, getting into hybrid or any sort of type of propulsion other than just the engine, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm dating myself. This is over a decade ago, probably, 2010 or so. The GT3 R hybrid, the unique thing about that, first of all, being a first GT competition race entered and pro sanctioned hybrid race car was pretty incredible. But the asterisk was a flywheel as the energy storage, and having that flywheel in a case next to the driver spinning at 70,000 RPM, it made a pretty wild sound. And there were a lot of questions from fans and media of, like, you're sitting next to a bowling ball case that's obviously many inches thick of I can't remember if it was aluminum or what the material of metal was, but clearly the innovation was to take sort of the KERS technology that was operational in Formula One at that time and store the energy that was created from deceleration into a flywheel that could then discharge into a front electric set of wheels. So you had combustion, GT3 flat six, naturally aspirated power in the rear axle. And then you had sort of an active front axle that was driven by energy storage and electricity. And the great thing about the concept and why I love hybrid technology is you're creating energy while driving in other ways that would otherwise be consumables, such as brake pads, et cetera. So you were able to replenish that system and then quote unquote boost out of the corners to get up to top speed and let the combustion engine sort of carry on from there. So it was a great first step for us. It was pre-918 release, which obviously is a battery combustion electric hybrid. And now when you look at the evolution and where everything has gone right from the top with GTP and LMDH and hypercar in all of the sort of front running IMSA and ACO sanctioned race cars, that means that at Daytona, at Le Mans, you have hybrid technology prototypes that are racing for overall and winning, because that ultimately is where the entire structure of sports car racing and endurance racing at a prototype level has gone. So it's great to be on the sort of ground level of that program and to see how much of that parallel still exists today in road car and our race car technology and strategy.
Because we were actually talking before, I think that was the first time that we met, and I was there. I was also very young at the time, clearly. And just remember, like, driving this thing. It was like one of those media days. It's like, you know, come on, you've got a race license. You can come down to Lausitzring in Germany and drive this thing. And I just remember it feeling nuts because you can. It was the first time I'd experienced something where if you started to get a little bit of slide on at the rear, you push the button on the steering wheel and it seemed to basically just put some torque at the front. And I suppose it's almost today what we talk about with torque vectoring. But this was actually quite manual. You push the button on the steering wheel, torque got sent to the front, and it just kind of like straightened itself up and spat itself onto the straightaway. And I think I only got a handful of laps and obviously didn't push it nearly as hard as you would have done, but I do remember it being amazing fun.
Yeah, it started out, like you said, with a manual boosting button where it was almost a push to pass. And if you were needing some handling adjustment mid-corner or you needed to get by a car, you had that electrification. And we used it at the Nürburgring racing in the 24 hours of Nürburgring. And it was unbelievable, especially with that amount of cars, you know, some 200 cars on the racetrack and how many classes, 30, 40 different classes. So there's often times where you were in a bunch of cars and lost your momentum. And then to get in into that boost button was incredible. As the program evolved, GPS and auto boosting became part of it. So it was almost finding out the most efficient way to use the electric power through a lap. And the engineers had developed different maps for qualifying versus racing. And they really understood A, where the car was on the track, and B, how to program in the boosting and how the auto boosting worked. So I remember going back to the Nürburgring with auto boosting and they thought, well, this is going to be great. Now we use every bit of electricity in the most ideal parts of the racetrack and you just drive like a normal car. What they underestimated is most of the time we were in traffic. So the ECU and the hybrid management system is seeing, okay, Pat's in certain corner. This is an efficient and effective time to boost. But of course, I've got four Mini Coopers in front of me and an old, you know, Lancia or something. So it was, we had an override button. So I'm getting very techy and into the weeds. But the great part about this is that it was always evolving. There was always something being addressed. And to be a driver that was really responsible to give that feedback and to come back and say, well, yes, I understand theoretically this is the most ideal way to discharge our electricity, but what about this and what about that? And so we were just run days and days of testing down in Nardo in the south of Italy at the test track, lots of days at the Nürburgring. We took the car to China and raced in that version was called IMLC, but it sort of adapted into the current WEC World Sports Car Championship. And yeah, just great memories of, again, not just getting paid to go fast or put down fast lap times, but how much the responsibility for a Porsche Works driver still is to be a developmental piece of the chain and really to work with the tech team at Flocked in Vysok and really see these cars come to life from a concept all the way to a customer supported and sold piece of property.
Matt was just playing on the screen. You can see, Patrick, the 997 GT3 RS 4 liter. And when people, you know, that really tedious dinner party question that we probably all get asked about, like the best car you've ever driven. That one for me was still a magical car. That if just that sweet spot of the end of an era, that was a fabulous car.
Yeah, a great car. Still love jumping back into those cars. I think it was a great sort of peek to the plot of a very kind of old school, visceral, you know, Metzger engine, early GT car, big engine, and just a great spec of the final 997 GT3. And then, you know, the next chapter going into 991 and introducing PDK and all the different evolution that has happened with rear steer and the list goes on of how much advancement has come from Andreas and the team in the GT department. The current GT3 RS would go circles around the 4 liter, but as far as a driver experience, I'm with you. One of the most epic cars and just so connected and still in all essence, a smaller water-cooled 911. So throwing that car around Barber on a wet morning, little did I know that that car would ever have the values that it's seeing today. At that point, that was just probably a PR car that the cars hadn't even gone live to the market. And JF and the team at Tangent Vector say, go out there and show us how sideways and how much yaw you can put into one of these cars on a wet morning at a beautiful track like Barber. So pretty amazing. I think about the value proposition of a car like that, and I would be over analyzing where I was going to drift that car or how close I was going to get to the edge of the racetrack. But, you know, being in your late 20s and having a development car at your hands, you just sort of throw caution to the wind.
It's a neat, it might be a neat segue into, because I it might be a neat segue into your part of your life now, but I do remember like 997 was, you know, when you put it next to 992, the current 911, how much smaller it is. And I have a 993, which if people not familiar with all the Porsche nomenclature, that's a last of the air-cooled 911s from the 1990s. So mine's a 97 car, but it's tiny. It's got the same wheelbase as a Miata.
Right.
Yeah. And then you realize then the 997, they've just got bigger and bigger. And then the current 911 is huge, particularly very, very wide.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go.
I think they are, yes, they are larger, but a lot of that comes down to safety and what is required for modern safety levels. In all essence of overall size, I would say a 911 is still one of the smaller performance cars out there, especially when you look at what they put in numbers for lap times or different measurables, as we talked about early in the conversation. And it's still a pretty tidy little package. But yeah, surely when you put a 997 next to a 992, you see just the surface area and the width of the car, let alone wheelbase, as you mentioned, with late 90s 993s. And I do get a little bit of a laugh when I drive an air-cooled 911, and you can sort of reach over and touch the passenger side window and realize just how tight it is in there.
You had mentioned the Taycan that you're driving. What else is in the garage? What do you got? Do you have a collection now?
I have a humble collection, but yes, I have started on a theme. Probably 2013, I bought my first vintage 911. I had talked about it and tire kicked for probably close to a decade since I had been exposed to those cars living in Germany and seeing them drive all around. And you know, people that work at Porsche, a lot of them drive air-cooled 911s to work. They're that passionate about the brand. So to answer your question, my go-to car right now is a 72 911. It's aubergine. I run it 2.7.
That one I've seen.
Yeah, that's a car I drive a lot, and I get a little bit of everything from that, from almost a daily driver chuckle to being able to hang with most anything in the canyon. So it's a fun one.
Yeah, but
that might be something to do with the driver.
No, I was just gonna say there. I think that has to do with the driver. Sure.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A little bit the car with the driver. So let's talk about collections. Let's talk about let's talk about the events, because that's a big part of the history and the collectability of some of these cars and telling those stories. So it started with Lufke Cult, something that you co-founded. Is this the 10th year?
This will be our 10th event, 11th year, because we took 2020 off for other reasons. But yeah, it's been quite a ride. It's funny to think that I really just wanted to throw my own little car gathering my way and with the help of some great friends. And it really just took off. We realized there was a demand in the market, and we've just been trying to keep up with it ever since 2014.
So was actually by chance. This was not something that, you know, you thought, well, my racing career, I'm getting a little older, whatever, but that I need to do. So you didn't envisage it just getting as big and as kind of culty as it's become.
No, I could never have dreamt of where this brand has taken me, not so much from a result standpoint, but more from an education standpoint and just running and leading a business. It really spawned from the passion and this hobby that I had found in owning a 1986 911, a 3.2 Carrera. And I had driven that car the day I picked it up. They flatbedded it out from New Jersey, and I jumped in it, took it to the DMV. And I just felt like I was watching a movie driving that car at 30 miles an hour, you know, through stoplights in West LA. And I was totally smitten. And it's funny because I made my living driving cars, and then I came home and, of course, jumped in a car and went for a drive. And I just wanted to go and learn about these cars and meet other people that had the same kind of driving passion and the sort of collectible side of really nerding out about the different specs and all the research I had done to acquire this first car, years of talking to people both internally at Porsche and other sort of people I had met through racing who happened to make their living during the week working at an air-cooled shop or developing a restomod business such as Rod Emery or Jeff Gamrot. These are guys that have been in the Porsche scene for decade on decade, but I met them at the racetrack at the pro racing level. But of course, when they got on a plane Sunday night and flew back, they went back to their shops where they prepped, serviced, restored, or created. And the evolution of the idea of putting my own car gathering on was I would drive this Porsche anywhere that I could. And I'd come out of a barbecue in Venice Beach, California at a friend's house. And there'd be a couple of neighbors standing around the car. And they had so many questions. And they just were sort of gazing at this car. And you could tell that they wanted to know where they could get one, where they could really get into the market and enjoy these cars. And I realized that there was such a gap between the passion for Porsche, at least in Southern California, and where to find and be educated. So I thought to myself, how would I tell the story of air-cooled? What would I call it? Where would it be? What time would it start? And what would those 40 cars be that you could walk through a parking lot on a Sunday morning with your family and your dog next to the baby stroller and really understand, as you referenced, all the different numbers that come along with the Porsche geek talk and really understanding why a 993 and a 964 and a G body and a G model and an F body, why they were all those things, or what was a resto mod, what was a survivor versus an R group, hot rod, sports purpose, all these different taglines. How could I tell that story with 40 cars and then sprinkle in a little bit of music and some tacos and a Corona and let everybody just hang out and not be standing in the middle of an empty strip mall parking lot at 6 a.m. talking about, you know, whether or not your wheel caps are the right period for your car.
You know, the first event,
we've all been there.
The first event was Venice, right? Venice and Lincoln. It was walking distance for where I was living at the time. And it was a nice idea, but it seemed like it outgrew that space before it even started. And then immediately grew. Was the second one downtown LA? And then the third was the Lumberyard.
Is that we went to Bandito Brothers, which was sort of a production studio in Culver City for number two. And then Modernica, as you referenced, in downtown Vernon, the kind of garment district area. And then, it just evolved. And I think the other part of the equation of sort of growing up, going to different types of car shows, whether it was my local car show in Westlake Village, California, where I am now, all the way to Pomona Swap Meet or going to Pebble Beach later on in my career or Amelia Island, is just sort of picking up little mental notes of what my ideal day out would be with great varied ownership and different types of subject matter. And I wasn't finding the car show I wanted. So I got together with Howie Idelson, who was a long friend all the way back from the 90s and go-karting and a creative guy that had a different view on things and didn't come from the Porsche world. And, you know, picked up the phone to Jeff Sword and to Alvin Springer and back to all these names of people that I've met, you know, through my racing career connected to this big Porsche family, and asked them to bring a car and to come out and leaned on them in what it should be. And, you know, I had an idea that it would take off pretty quick. I had already, my trademarks were already filed and the t-shirts were printed. And we did have this idea of building out a brand from the onset, but never did I imagine that there would be a line of Porsches, you know, a mile down the street, lining both sides of Lincoln Boulevard our first time throwing the show.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you were expecting it to blow up as quickly and as large as it did, but it is, it's actually nice to hear that there was a bit of a business plan behind it. There was a thought process on making it a business and then seeing how it goes. And then it grew very, very quickly and it turned into arguably the premier event, not just a Porsche event, but it's completely changed the way I think people are putting on these car show events, right? And if that's even what we're calling it now, I'm sure we can come up with something, or if it hasn't been already, a better term for it, this experience.
I agree with Matt. I mean, like my local, I love my local Cars and Coffee in Southern California, because people turn up with, you know, 959s and Daytona Spiders and all sorts of things. And it's great. It's just like a bunch of people, turning up with a food truck and enjoying. But the idea of having something curated where you feel like you're in a kind of living museum and you learn something and you see something the first time, you talk to people, it's a different kind of experience. And I love the idea of curating it in different locations. I know the Universal Studios, where I was telling Matt, I took my 3-week-old daughter to the Luft at Universal Studios, which I'd having been to Lumberyard one, I thought I could just walk in with her. And it was my first kid. I was spectacularly naive. There's actually a baby in there on the picture. And I remember realizing that I was way out of my depth and having to beg somebody in a golf cart to take me out again, because I'd got no idea what I was doing. But it was an amazing day out. And that must have been a hell of a thing to put on with Universal Studios, because it was an incredible location.
Yeah, the madness of Luft and part of the recipe was, let's take Porsche people into new territory and tell the stories of our venue, and to create themes and to really make this a day out for the passionate followers of the brand. But let's also let our venues bring a completely new community to the Porsche world and let them sort of cross-pollinate. So we've been a little bit wild in our thoughts of, could we do this in the Universal Studios backlot? Could we stroke a check and take over something as picturesque, where so many famous movies have happened and there's so much diversity in the backdrop and the architecture, from scenes of old Wild West and Mexico all the way down to New York, and where so many scenes have been shot. I mean, Back to the Future over at the clock tower. I mean, these are different scenes that we've all sort of grown up, if we're from the same era, watching films. So yeah, bringing Porsche and Hollywood together and telling stories of that sort of love affair between Porsche and Hollywood, dating all the way back to the 50s. And that's always been the fun in curating the venue as much as we're curating the cars. I think that as it grows, it's a little bit of a double standard, because you want to keep the venues very exciting. And ultimately, we have to recreate ourselves every single time we go to a new city with a new fire marshal and a new venue restriction rule and logistics of how are we going to get 6,000 or 7,000 people from the parking lot into the back lot of Universal, as you referenced. But I love the challenge. It is not easy or for the faint of heart. And it's taught me so much about how to produce shows that take care of the car owner and the enthusiast who spends their time to bring their car out and to let people get around it and enjoy it and learn, but also that the attendee is a much bigger percentage of people who are consuming this experience. I would say 6 or 7, 8 to 1. These are people showing up in their daily driver and walking through the gate for a day out, an art show, a happening, a festival, some type of blend of one of those things, where you really get to spend a day consuming all this and meeting people. I think that the big draw has been how much of the connection is online these days, and to really get somewhere that these people who trade images of their cars and talk Porsche all day can fly to one destination and meet up with their friends that are online friends.
Let's talk a little bit about Air Water. Are you calling this the evolution of events, or is this sort of described as something very, very different?
No, this is a different product, a different brand, different website, and just sort of a culmination of the first decade of Luft, and creating a sister brand that caters to a different experience. It's different cars. It's all generations of Porsche, race and street, four-door, two-door, vintage and modern. But the experience from the show aspect, if you remove the cars from the conversation for a minute, it's all the places that Luft might limit us in how or when we produce a show that doesn't sell out in a week or two for tickets, or has space for more cars to come in and be a part of the show. I think trade is something that's been a big part of what we've kept out of Luft. Unless you're a committed annual sponsor and willing to work with us and collaborate on how you might activate or market on site during a Luft, it's a no. So air water is an idea to allow, you know, product and Porsche relatable aftermarket companies to come in and to talk about and display what they're doing. It's also about a live auction idea. I've always wanted to collaborate with our partners at Broad Arrow and do a live auction. And Ian and Alexander Weaver, Ian Keller, these guys are friends, and they were our first sponsor at Luft at their former job place and brand in the auction space. And we've been kicking this idea around for a long time. So I needed a venue with enough scale to have a live auction going on in the middle of 1,000 cars from enthusiasts, indoor, outdoor space, and scalability that I think Southern California has the potential for. Orange County doesn't have a lot of big automotive events on the national calendar. And so I want to, with my team, build a complete immersive weekend, a Porsche Mania weekend right in the middle of Costa Mesa, California. This is year one of Air Water as a standalone event, April 27th, coming up soon. And we're just going to see how it goes. We listen to our attendees. We listen to the enthusiasts. We listen to the first timers. I've always said with Luft, and I think this remains a parallel with Air Water, you have your legends of the Porsche world have been there and done that and are pretty uninspired by any car of any value or magnitude. And then you have your first timers who really don't care or aren't infected by the love for all the stories just yet. What do those two demographics take away in a day when they come to Air Water? And then right in the middle of all that, of course, is the meat and the passion and the Porsche file, if you will. And how do we create a great day out for all three and really introduce and open up the doors to people who might not own a Porsche or know anything that I'm rambling on about right now?
You mentioned the auction as well, and I think that's a good component to add to it. And we've seen that we're starting to see some of that happen more and more as auctions pop up at events like the Jet Center party up in Monterey, how Broad Arrow brought their auction there. Now it's, I forgot what's the name of the party now.
Motorlux.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember they switched about a year or two ago, and that was a home run for them. That worked out very well. But in the world of collectability, because we talked about so much of your racing history and what you've done, have you been keeping track of where your racing cars are? Because it seems like that is the next evolution of collectability. If people aren't jumping on your cars now, Porsche probably has the right mind to go, we're keeping everything and probably have it in their museum, because they look at the values of these cars over the past however many years that, but you know, look, 80s racing cars are really taking off. 80s rally cars are taking off as far as value. They're huge successes at the car auctions. We have to be looking at your racing career and your cars, right?
I mean, I still struggle with a little bit of imposter syndrome, but let me take my humility hat off for a minute and say that, yeah, there's cars that I own and cars that I've driven and had opportunities to win big races like the classics at Le Mans. They're currently on display in the Porsche section of the Peterson Museum today. And that's a huge honor for me. It's something I never would have ever dreamt of. You know, I just wanted to race go-karts, ride dirt bikes and get paid to race for one weekend. That was my goal, to call myself a pro for one weekend. But the value proposition of storied cars where, come on, let's be real, I'm one of three drivers and there's another 20 on the crew. So I happen to be on some great efforts that won some big classics, and those cars are in private hands these days. And for whatever reason, these cars change hands. You know, you find something bigger and better, you get into the harder drugs, you got to move a few of your race cars out of your garage. And so they find their way to the market, and it's often hard to value these cars because they are so preserved and they're still in their liveries and they tell all the stories with how many victories they've had and who drove them. So an auction has kind of been the equalizer there. It's like, you think this car is worth X? Let's put it on the block and let the audience decide. So I think there's great enthusiasm to have an auction happening in parallel, coming up next weekend. The reality of it is that the auction is let's call it 1,000 people, 1,500 people could consume that and dip their head in for no cost if they're at the event. But there's still another 7,000 people outside that are going to have plenty to do and plenty to eat and hopefully some great sun and places to hang out amongst acres of sort of an attraction theme park for car people. There's a Flying Lizard car from 2007. I believe I drove and raced that car at Long Beach and Detroit that year. It's a Troy Lee Design art car. It's the first ever Troy Lee Designs collaboration with Flying Lizard. My name was on it. I saw it last night at a preview party at Garage and Social. And I thought to myself in 07, I must have just dabbled in that car for a couple of races. But that car, I think, is somewhere in an estimate of $600,000 to $800,000. I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that it'll go into the seven-figure realm next Saturday. So I hope I'm not overhyping it.
Yeah,
it's get some egos involved, get everybody getting a bit competitive on a Saturday morning. And I've been to the auction in the middle of the Goodwood Festival of Speed a couple of times. So that's always kind of fun because it feels part of the event and you get a few celebrities turning up and spending stupid money. And it adds to the occasion. No question.
It is fun. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Even if you're not a buyer, I was in the room in Amelia Island this year and I dive in there for an hour or two, watch a few cars go across the block and then move on into other sort of offerings that the event has. But of course you have people who fly in from, transcontinental flights that are researching these cars for a private collector who's been eyeing up a car. Last night I met a gentleman from Germany who was an ex Porsche factory mechanic long before I was a Porsche factory driver, but he introduced himself and said that his client had sent him out to research this 908-2 that will be sold next weekend or offered next weekend. And I think the reserve on that car is, in the $4 million range. So pretty wild to see a Le Mans class winner roll across the block in the middle of air water coming up next Saturday.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing. It sounds amazing. Give it all the best with it. Unfortunately, I can't. I'm away, which is gutting. I hadn't probably sorted my schedule properly in time, so I won't make it down. But it does sound like an amazing event, and hope it goes well.
Well, the event is April 27th at the OC Fairgrounds. Is that right? Orange County Fairgrounds here in Southern California. So you guys still have time. Now, this is the event is already curated as far as the cars and stuff that are going to be on display. That part of it is sold out, but you can go to the event. You can buy tickets. You can go to the website. It's air-water.com. And you click on the event. You can go and get tickets there. I don't know what they start about $50, which seems like a pretty good deal to me for considering everything you're going to be able to go and see and experience down there. So this is the first event. Let's make this event a huge, huge hit for these guys, as I'm sure it will be. Either way, but check it out April 27th. Again, it's air-water.com. Get your tickets there. Patrick, thanks so much. I know we could probably just do another hour or so, but we're kind of up against it on time for today. Am I going to see you at Long Beach at the Grand Prix?
I'm going to dive in there Friday for a couple of hours. So yeah, I'd love to connect with you if you're there at that point. And
I think I'm going to be there Sunday for race day. You got to go and see the Indy cars. Then after they bring out the stadium trucks, and that's just crazy to see on the streets of Long Beach, which is it's a blast to see that as well. And then the following weekend, of course, is the Air Water event. Patrick, thanks so much. And if you guys want to keep tabs on Patrick, you can go to patricklong.com. That's his website. And from there, you can also follow his social media accounts, which you'll find them there as well. Pat, thanks so much. And we'll see you soon, buddy.
Thanks for having me, guys. Good to catch up.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep the air and the spare in the bag and the wheel.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.